Hi, everybody. We're live. We're here. Thank you for your patience. We were running a little bit late, but congratulations, Karen, on your 21st, right? Best-selling novel, False Witness. And it's my pleasure to be here for your launch day. Congratulations. And
yeah, I'm very happy to be here with you because I've known you since I was a tyke.
A writing tyke. We were writing tykes.
I was still very young, thank you.
Right. You were a teenager. I was 33. But that's
where you go.
But congratulations. And it's an honor to be here tonight to host this evening of celebrating you with a lot of wonderful bookstores. And thank you so much for all the bookstores who are participating. And thank you for all of you for being here. So you and I like a lot of the same themes in books, both as writers, and I know also we like to read the same kinds of things we like to write. But so two of the themes that I think we come back to over and over again are that the past is never really past, right? It has a way of creeping into your present and shaping your future. And we're also both, I think, kind of fascinated by families, that they can be difficult and complicated, and yet they also, like the past, never leave you, right? So in this book, I think you've managed to kind of bring both of those together as two sisters who had, it's in the prologue, so I'm not spoiling anything. Somebody dies that they have something to do with as young girls. And it comes, now that they're older, they are two very different women. Right. And yet the sister relationship lasts, and that thing they did in the past together can't quite stay hidden, and it comes back into the present. So what is the thing? I know you don't like to lay out what your whole book is about, but what is it that brings that secret back into the present?
Something horrible.
Is this what we're doing? I feel like I'm interviewing Prince.
So Lee is a lawyer in her adult life, and a client comes in, and her boss says, "This is your client," so she has no choice but to take him. And he's connected to this bad thing that happened in the past. So you have a person in the way of Lee Collier, who's used to being in complete control of everything in her life. And this client just spins everything out of control and she loses her shit.
And is it too much of a spoiler to say who the client is?
I think so.
It's too much.
So. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So far I've only said things that happen in the prologue, so I won't go into what happens on page 80, but I thought the setup, you know, it's always hard to talk to a suspense writer about their work because the whole point is the book is suspenseful. So I can't even tell you what it's about, but we're supposed to talk about it. But the setup of it is that somebody who was supposed to stay hidden in the past comes back into the present in this surprising way. And it has to do with this big case that she's required to work. And one of the many things I admire about, you know, your whole body of work is you write both series books. You also write standalones. Like, you're not writing the same book over and over and over again. Every book is different. You're willing to kind of move outside of the box. To me, this read like the best kind of legal thriller. It's not like tons of courtroom scenes, but you've got one of the two main characters is a lawyer, and it feels very real. Do you think of this book as your legal thriller that you wrote?
Well, maybe a little bit. You know, The Good Daughter also had lawyers in it, but you know, you helped me a lot with this book. So if anything feels realistic, it's because I was texting you going, does this violate HIPAA, or, you know, how does this work? Or spousal privilege was a big thing. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that laws are very nuanced from state to state. So it was extra work for you to figure out what something would be in Georgia. So I was really
like, hold on, got to go learn about Georgia. No, it was very little work, but it showed to me though, like, so for those of you who don't know, it was very little work, but when she did have a question about something legal, she would ask me, and the lazy part of me was just like, just make it up, Karen. No one's going to know. And she's like, no, I want it to be right. And I'm like, okay, guess I'm going to go pull up the Georgia Law Library. So I can tell you if anything's wrong, it's my fault. It's not
her. I'm good with that.
But there's not much legal detail into it, but mm-hmm. just the way you used the structure of a criminal case and her split role, right? She's got a personal interest because of her background and how this case gets resolved and how she feels about this client. But at the same time, you know, she's stuck in this professional role. And so you kind of naturally gave her an internal conflict. And that's not even to talk about her sister. So what's her sister like?
Her sister, Callie, is the exact opposite of her. And because of this trauma they both experienced, you know, Lee's response was to be in control. Callie's is to completely abdicate control. And she's really in the thrall of a very serious addiction. But, you know, as someone who has family members who have struggled with addiction and who has loved those family members despite some of the things they've done, it was really important for me to show her as a real person and to give her some agency. Because normally when you read about junkies or you see them on television, they're kind of pathetic or they're horrible people or, you know, and so Callie likes animals, you know, she works at a vet clinic. She loves fish and she loves coming up with crazy names for animals. And sure, she has this addiction and she's doing some bad things, but at her heart, she's a really nice person with a very tender side. And that was an important part for me to write about her, was to show this real life human being who wasn't defined by her addiction.
So you've talked in the past about how you try to balance the entertainment value that people expect when they come to a thriller, right? It's not supposed to be a huge bummer. And it's not supposed to feel like a lecture. We know all the reasons why we love to read a fast paced thriller, but you also very clearly in your work are willing to, I think you describe it as kind of a holding a mirror up to society and talking about the things that are going on in the moment. And it was like, I'm not giving anything away, I promise. Like even on page 32, like I marked this page up, like within three paragraphs in a way that doesn't feel like a lecture. It doesn't feel like this pronouncement where the author says, and now I'm going to talk about income inequality. But Lee talks about the fact that, you know, she used to be a public defender representing prostitutes, junkies, and petty thieves with no resources. And now she's kind of sold out to the man. And she says, these people are doing the same crimes as my previous clients, but they have the money to get away with it. And the reason she has sold out to the man is so that she can send her kid to like a private posh school during COVID because it's safer and her kid can get a better education than, you know, maybe her previous peers couldn't. And she feels guilt about that. And then she talks about having to compete at work with these 20 somethings who are buried in law school debt and will sleep in their offices to make a career for themselves. And it's just like, I'm like, you pack so much in about sort of the ills of society. What themes, like, I mean, is that just like where your head lives? Or when you wrote this, did you kind of make a purposeful decision? Like, these are the themes that are going to kind of linger in the background.
You know, I mean, it's just really organic for me. And these are, I think, important issues. And, you know, from us having conversations, how I feel about these things. But I think there are issues that a lot of people don't think about until they have to. You know, if you can sit back and say the criminal justice system, okay, well, there's some flaws, but it works how it's supposed to work for the most part. But then if you get involved in it, you're like, holy crap. This is awful. I can't believe this stuff happens. I can't believe how many innocent people take a plea deal because they got kids to support. They need a job. Or, you know, somebody gets busted for some pot. They get out of prison a year later. And, you know, if you're not a criminal when you go in, you're usually one when you come out because it's such a tough way to live. But then they can't get employment and we don't give them any help for, you know, returning to life as citizens. So that was, you know, just something that felt really organic. Because one thing that the pandemic showed us is if you're on a cruise ship or a prison or in an old folks home, you know, you're marked by this disease, and it should make us look at how people live in those situations. You know, only one is completely voluntary. The other two Right. are generally not.
So speaking of the pandemic, on a less depressing note, though, somebody named Greg asked, if you're willing to share, are we wearing real pants, like hard, are we wearing hard, what I call hard clothes today, or are you wearing sweatpants? What you got going on down there?
I'm in my pajama shorts, and I'm barefoot. Are you kidding?
I have this very forgiving top on, and I'm totally wearing some gym shorts and bare feet, y'all. For those of you who wanted to know. Okay, so this is where things might go awry, but we're going to try getting fancy. And we have some surprise guests popping in to congratulate you tonight on your great book. And the first is Francesca. Is there a way to connect her? So Francesca Montplaisir it should be getting connected soon. Is she here?
I'm here.
There you are. Yay. For those of you who don't know about Francesca, her book, My Mother's House, is a spectacular book from last year. And her next book is The Garden of Broken Things. So I'm going to turn it over to you all while I think I'm going to magically disappear. If this works.
She did.
Look at that.
Hey, Karen. Congratulations. Hello.
Thank you. I want to say congratulations on your new book, which our shared agent hasn't sent me a copy of.
Oh, that's because I'm still reading the final.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it. July 29th. We're supposed to say our greeting, but I know it has pas in it. You taught me some Haitian. Yes, passé. Say passé. Yes.
Yes, baboule.
Okay, you lost me.
No worries. But in the interest of disclosing what I'm wearing, not hard pants, gym shorts, barefoot, that's it.
You know, I had an event last night at Foxtel's bookstore, an in-person event, and it's right outside of Atlanta. And I realized as I was getting ready that I actually had to look at what the back of my hair looks like. Because I haven't done that in a year and a half, because it just hasn't mattered. I mean, even when I like finally went back to the hairdresser, I was like, just do this part. Don't
do this part.
I can be a Keith Cassidy in the back. I don't care.
Same. I hit a lot of things up here. Oh my gosh. So the book opens up summer 1988. What were you doing in the summer of 1998?
1998, sorry. 98. I was hanging in my crib, yo. 98, I don't know. I think I was actually like trying to be an adult and I had a real job. In 96, we had the Olympics in Atlanta. Right. So that was a really big deal. Wow, I didn't even think about putting myself in the context of that time period. Because you know, when you write characters, you know that they're not you, really. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think about the fact that I was alive. I'm a little freaked out now to think about. You know,
I thought about it, too. I was like, wow, I was also alive in 1988. So, yeah.
A very good year. Yes. Yeah. So. But, you know, if you think about what was going on in the world around that time, especially how we kind of vilified young women. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody knows the Britney Spears story, which, yeah. You know, I'm totally free Britney. Or, you know, you can lock up Kanye and all the rest of the guys even. But it was like around the time that we had the Long Island Lolita story about Amy Fisher. And, you know, she absolutely deserved to be punished for attempted murder. She tried to kill Joey Buttafuoco's wife, Mary Kay. Is that right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember very clearly how she kind of lost her teenagehood in that, you know, people just forgot this really creepy older guy was molesting a teenage girl. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she knew a lot of the language to say and all the sexualized language because that was really popular then. But emotionally, she wasn't an adult.
Yeah, she was a child.
And
child.
she was trafficked basically as well. Yeah. So, you know, but we tend to let, especially, you know, young men, they stop being boys the minute we suspect them of a crime. They're suddenly men. Yeah. And we do that with women in sexual situations too. So mm-hmm. when I was writing the opening to that, I was really conscious of that and all that. And I mean, I love the Drew Barrymore movie of the week about Amy Fisher just as much as everybody else. Mm-hmm. But it made me think, well, how would that story be told today? Would we still vilify this 16, 17 year old girl like she's just some, you know, assassin and cold blooded sexualized Lolita? Or would we say,
if she was a black girl, absolutely.
We wouldn't have heard about her. Police would have shot her.
Yeah, sure. But if she was a black girl, you know, that's one of the things that studies have shown, that black girls are over-sexualized at a very, very young age, 10, 12 years old, and they're being referred to as women or young women in the media. So very much so. Yeah.
It's true. And I would invite you to just talk to a girl that age, because you don't remember this when you were that young, but you're really stupid. you can kind of pretend for about 5 minutes. But then when things get real, it's like, oh, this is not a fully formed adult.
Yeah, you know? I'm not sure I'm a fully formed adult even now. So
it's hard. I'm just going to say, yeah.
So tell me, Lee and Callie, who are you? Which are you most like?
You know, I'm more like a Lee, because as you know, I'm very type A, very driven, you know, very OCD, not as educated. Absolutely. I'm a college dropout. Go Panthers. But I think Callie has more of my sense of humor because she's very strange. And you also know I'm very strange. So you know, she's the person that laughs at something that no one else is laughing at. Yeah. But what I love about that is the only person in the room who laughs at her jokes is her sister. Because they just get each other at that main level. And I have that with my own sister. You know, she understands my crazy sense of humor and gets what I'm saying.
Yep. I have a sister too, and it's the same thing. It's the same thing. We finish each other's sentences, and I don't know who rescues whom most, but we rescue each other when need be.
I mean, that's just, it's a line I use in the book. When one of them is weak, the other one is strong, and it just is a way that balances each other out. So
absolutely.
It can be a good relationship.
Absolutely.
Especially
so I
got to
ask you about your background, because that's the pandemic lockdown thing to do, right? So obviously we have all of your books, including in some other languages.
Yes.
But I see the four bottles, and I can only see four bottles of liquor back there. And I'm wondering if one of them is Patron Platinum by any chance?
Wow. Good eye. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Way to go.
I know my tequila.
Yeah. But you know, the crazy thing is I don't really drink. I would much rather have a cupcake, but this seemed to like fit with the pandemic. You know, I got the theme. I got the toilet paper, the little baby toilet paper that a fan knitted for me. So I got it all going on.
Yeah.
But I think you owe the world a good Zoom background if you're going to do these things.
Absolutely. I don't have a great one up today, but normally I would have flowers in the background, feel like I'm in a nice little garden. But
yeah, well, thanks for making an effort.
I put on makeup. I haven't worn a full face of makeup in a very, very, very,
okay.
very long time.
All right. I appreciate
that. For my corporate job.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. I appreciate that.
Okay,
thank you.
Oh gosh. So I had asked you this before with The Silent Wife, but I will ask you the same question again. Cast. Who would you cast in the role of Lee and Callie?
You know, I don't know, because they don't really have faces to me. I know that's weird. And I haven't thought about it in that context. You know, I shouldn't say this because Alifair is listening, but Lee is a kind of, a part of her character is an homage to Alifair, because when Alifair was growing up, you know, her dad was a poor college professor and, you know, they struggled as a family. And Alifair was like always hustling, always doing jobs. And, you know, she got into Stanford and, you know, she is a law professor now and she's got all these different jobs she's doing, writing her own books, Mary Higgins Clark books, you know. So she's pretty freaking amazing, which makes it honestly hard to be her friend. but I mean, I was thinking of Alifair when I wrote about Lee's early beginnings, because Lee lives in a really, you know, rough neighborhood and she has to kind of fight her way up. She ends up going to Northwestern. So, you know, I admire people who can do that, because it seems like, you know, the American dream doesn't happen that often anymore.
Right.
Like, that's what we think of. You pull yourself up, you get education, you do well. And I have such admiration for that.
Brilliant. So I have to say, and I'm not giving anything away about the book, the opening fight scene is effing amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
I love a good ass whooping. It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. And so I just had to compliment you on that for sure.
Well, thank you.
21 books. How in the hell?
You know, I don't know. I really don't. I look at all these books and I'm like, wow, I can't believe I wrote that. And I'll think, well, what's this one about? And I'll open it and the whole thing will come back to me. It's so crazy just to think about. And also to think that, you know, I started when I was 12 and it's been 21 great years.
Wow. So you started when you were just a stupid little girl.
Exactly. Now I'm a brilliant young woman.
Yes.
Well, I have been blushing in the green room. And also I think Francesca like is a celebrity author interviewer. That was amazing. I was like, she is very good at this. You should do all the author interviews. So thank you for doing that.
Absolutely. Kisses. Wonderful. Congratulations. And thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All righty. Bye.
Thanks. I have a couple questions from the Ask a Question. So for those of you watching virtually, there is a little button at the bottom of your screen that says Ask a Question. I probably won't get through all of them since we have more surprise guests to pop in. But so a couple of questions came through. Sherry and Chrissy sort of had related questions that I thought I could blend together probably about. So you write series books and you also write standalones. This one, to be clear, is a standalone. Some people weren't sure on that. But so when do you decide, how do you know whether it's time to write a standalone or when it's time to write a series? And then this is where I fold in the other person's question. When you do get back to a series, like, you know, recently you were able to bring in Jeffrey Tulliver again, like some of your beloved characters, like how does it feel like when you get to occupy their voice again after being away for a while? So it's a two-parter.
It is. You know, the story tells me what it's going to be. Right. And a lot of times when I'm thinking about an idea, it's very clearly a Will, Trent and Sarah Linton idea. So it starts more with, you know, the framework of it is I know this will be an investigation. So I know, you know, the basic patterns of that. And with a story like this, it starts more with character because I'm doing a standalone. So, you know, I need to know this character. As you know, when you say you're going to write a book about something, you're going to be with those people for a really long time and you're going to be like spending a lot of hours with them. So it has to be a character you're very interested in. And, you know, Lee came to me first about 3 years ago because I was doing a lot of research for my Will Trent book, which has Faith Mitchell. And Faith is something that I cannot ever relate to. She's got a baby. Right. And that's like, I know nothing about babies. I don't want to know about them. I find them very boring. You know this. It's like, why can't it hold up its head? I don't understand. You know? So I read a lot of these mommy blogs. A lot of moms do think babies are boring also, just FYI.
It is. I know. People, hopefully you're not having a child to have a baby because they don't actually stay babies.
No,
you
know, no, they're very spoiler boring. Alert.
Yeah. You kind of have to like get through that part.
It's only 18 years.
If you want a permanent baby, there's no real way to do that. Get a dog.
Right. Well, maybe they're working on it. Maybe that's why they're going into space. So, you know, with this, it was like reading this mommy blog, and I saw this cartoon that was all the kids in the school play, like the nose picker and the mama's boy and the drama queen. And I thought, that is something that has never, ever occurred to me, is that parents have to sit through these boring plays with kids, or worse, a musical. And so I just started thinking about Lee being in the audience and doing something that probably a lot of moms have done, is like done instead of fantasy football, they're fantasy moms if the apocalypse happens, you know? So you want the one who made the math teacher cry, or the one who like sold enough toilet paper on the black market to get a MacBook. I'd want you, because I know you could kick some ass.
When you described me as like a little child hustler, I'm like, always had jobs, man. I joked one time that if I actually LinkedIn, you're supposed to include every job you've ever had. I'm like, oh God, that would be like a 3-day thing for me. And it would start when I was like 4.
Right. You have to go back to Benetton.
Yes. That was another job I had. I was a big mall girl. All right. So I think we are overdue for our next special guest. I think I'm right on that. The order we're going in. So I think our next special guest is Beverly Jenkins. And my guess, given that you are a crime reading audience, people know Beverly from her romantic suspense books, but she is a well-known romance and romantic suspense author. She's a recipient of the Romance Writers of America Nora Roberts Lifetime Achievement Award. She's gotten RT Choice Awards, a familiar name to a lot of people. So thank you, Beverly, for being here. We're all celebrating you. So I'm going away. I'm going to turn
it over.
All
right. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, girl. How are you?
I'm very well. Where are you right now in D.C.?
I am in Mayberry, which is my name for my small town.
Okay.
I'm about 45 minutes west of Detroit, which was my hometown.
Oh, okay.
So, and as for clothes, I'm sitting here in my Captain America t-shirt, Sam Wilson. My sleep pants, bare feet, house shoes.
Shoes? I didn't know I was talking to royalty.
Yeah, he's talking to royalty. They're old shoes, though. It's like, okay, you know, dirty shoes.
Normally when I finish a book, I buy a pair of shoes to wear when I go on tour. Mm-hmm. And when I finished this, when I was looking online, I was like, does anyone wear shoes anymore?
I know.
It's crazy.
You buy shoes, I go to the Dooney and Burke link and pick up a new bag. So
you're fancier than I am.
Well, you know, yes. Hey, I feel like I've worked hard enough. I should treat myself to something.
Absolutely.
You know, nobody's going to treat you if you don't treat yourself. So
that's spend how it I all. Who are you saving it for?
Right. Kids aren't going to get it. So, you know,
So I really enjoyed your book, Wild Rain, that came out
good,
in February.
Good.
Yes.
Yeah. Sort of like what you were talking about with, you know, people being influenced by their past. And she is all barbed wire and, you know, hard ass and don't want kids, you know, very, 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 you know, loud about that, which you don't usually get sometimes in romance. And he's a nerd and he's fascinated by her. He's a reporter from DC. He's never seen a woman wear a gun belt before, so he's sort of out of his element, but fascinated by her. So that's a book. I don't even know what number it is for me.
240
maybe. No, that's Nora. That's Brenda Jackson and Nora.
You can't catch up with her. Well, so how do you decide if something's going to have a little element of suspense in it?
I usually do
classic suspense. I think your books are very suspenseful just because you don't know what's going to happen.
You know, I do the contemporary suspense. I haven't done those in a while. I'm doing one right now, which is a little novella. But I love them because I get to blow stuff up. I get to have car chases. I get to, you know, shoot people and all of that. And sometimes you have that element in my historicals, but usually, you know, it's the contemporaries and, you know, black op helicopters and I have one book. My daughter's like, "Ma, we really need a movie. I want to see this woman drive this SUV through the front of this 7-Eleven." You know, so yeah.
So well, how have you? Based on real life, somebody driving an SUV through a 7-Eleven. I almost did it many times in college.
Yeah, I'm looking for a new car. She's trying to get me to buy a SUV, and I'm like, nah.
Research.
I do. I drive a 6-speed Honda, so it's like,
oh, okay.
You know, the fastest point between fastest distance between A and B is speed. So she's like, "You're too old to be doing that," and I'm like,
never.
Get out of my house. Get out of never. My house. So never, never. So how has the pandemic been for you?
You know, I'm very introverted. And I thought, you know, hey, you've been living this pandemic lifestyle for a really long time. It's going to be easy. But I didn't realize how anxiety making it would be. I mean, just like at a very real level, watching the numbers of deaths, you know, I had to like stop looking at that website, the Johns Hopkins one, because it was just horrifying. You know, a lot of women my age, they lost their fathers or they lost family members. You know, we had people who couldn't go to funerals and all that. I mean, it was just really horrible. And that's for my place of relative privilege, right? Because I work from home.
Right.
You know, I know I'm going to be okay. I know I got one contract at least for a book. So, you know, there's going to be food on the table, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I couldn't imagine what it was like for other people. And my sister, for instance, you know, she collects rent for landlords, but with the eviction moratorium, a lot of people couldn't afford rent. Well, the landlords couldn't afford not to have rent, and my sister couldn't afford to employ my sister. So, you know, things like that, that you just don't even think about the impact they have until you start seeing all of it in real life. And that was really hard to see. Hopefully we're not going back into that.
Well, yeah, it's so scary, but I'm an extrovert, but I live an introverted life. I mean, I don't leave the house unless I'm going to church or, you know, I've had my groceries delivered probably for the last 4 years. So I get that part, but I lost my mother-in-law on a Friday, and then I lost my mom 3 days later on the Monday.
Oh, no.
Couldn't have funerals.
Right.
You know, couldn't have the church homegoing that both of them were old and due, but I mean, you get through it, but not the way you want to get through it. So,
yeah.
But you know, hey, we keep riding. That's
right.
The only thing I could control.
Yeah,
is riding. So.
That's what I found, right? That it was like the one thing that you had. You knew what was going to happen. Right. Because there's so much uncertainty. I don't think human beings are wired for uncertainty.
No,
we just can't handle it. Like if you had said a year and a half ago, hey, we're all going to be finished with this in 2 years. Everybody would have been OK. You know, we'll do it as long as we know when it's going to be over.
Right.
And that's what's really gotten to us, I think.
Yeah.
Made people angry.
Yeah. You know, not being able to control stuff and then being told that you must do certain things in order to help, you know, the many.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just couldn't get with the program, which is why we're in the mess we're in right now. So,
yeah.
But, you know, we survive, hopefully.
Yeah.
We keep going and keep writing books because our readers use us as their escape a lot of times.
So, yeah. Well, you know, your books in particular, I think you talk a lot about social issues and some of the things that have come up recently that the pandemic has sort of put a magnifying glass on.
Yeah.
But do you think you'll talk about the pandemic in any way?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, you never say never, of course. But, you know, I'm more interested in how the past is the present.
Yeah. Preach.
Okay. You know, past is the present. I mean, we went through this in the 19th century after, you know, Reconstruction was gutted. Same, you know, dumb shit. So I prefer that as opposed to writing about all of the horror and the death and the, you know, the pandemic. But never say never. You never know.
You never know. Maybe never some know. Futuristic love in space.
There you go.
I mean, they just sent a big vibrator up there. So,
oh, Jesus, yes. You know, a big, what we call in romance, a big peen went to space. A magic peen went to space. I know. But I was reading about, you know, I'm a big proponent of libraries. Mm-hmm. Always have been. And I was reading about your foundation. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's called Save the Libraries. We've given away almost 100,000, I'm sorry, half a million, 500,000 bucks to libraries. Wow. And, you know, it's just kind of a way to give back. I got my start in a library. I mean, I just to be really honest, you know, I grew up in the South. We didn't have air conditioning and that building was air conditioned. So that's why I was there. but then I was like, oh, look, there's books.
Yeah.
So yeah. That was my escape. That was the way I learned about other people. You know, I was always very curious about different ways that people thought, because I knew that I didn't think the same way a lot of people did. So I'm like, let me look at this book. You know, maybe this person's weird like me, or maybe this person loves these kinds of stories. And, you know, it was at the library with the librarians putting books in my hand, like taking V.C. Andrews from my cold, dead hands and saying, hey, why don't you try Dickens? Why don't you try Flannery O'Connor? Why don't you know something other than this? Not to knock V.C. Andrews, because I love those books. And I think anytime anybody's reading, that's a good thing. So it really changed my life to have the library there.
Yeah, I think the best gift you can give a kid is a library card.
Absolutely, because they leave. They just get out of your house.
Yeah, they get out of your house and it takes you places. You know, here I was a poor kid on the east side of Detroit, and you know, I spent every Saturday in the library.
Yeah, it's a safe space, and they've done so much during the pandemic too. Even though the buildings have been closed, they've been giving hotspots to kids and laptops and all that stuff. So they're still there. We just need to be there for them too.
Exactly. Anytime you need help, let me know. Okay.
Will do. Thank you.
Right. You're welcome. Bye-bye. Thanks.
I feel like I'm the person who comes and cuts off the really great conversation. Like, it's been fun for me to listen. Like, I've been laughing out loud. Yeah, it was great. So I am monitoring the questions that people are posting. I'll try to fit in a couple between each speaker. So this is a quickie, but Lauren Dunnigan pointed out that you have a very well-suited name for a crime writer. That I know the answer to this, but is that your real name or did you pick that name?
No, it's my real name. I grew up with it. I was teased mercilessly for it because that's what you want to be when you're a little girl, is called Slaughter or Sergeant Slaughter. Or at gym, you know, where I had my period every single day for the coach to say, Slaughter, get off the bench.
Oh,
yeah, that
God.
Was great. So I feel like I came by it honestly.
And then Teresa asked if you have, is there one good piece of writing advice if you had to pick one quick tip?
Right. I mean, you know, that's the hard part. The idea is so much easier. You know, everybody has a great idea, but figuring out how to implement that, sitting your butt in the chair every day, that's the job of being a writer, as we both know.
It's butt in chair. You can't wait for the muse to hit you. It is, you got to make the donuts.
That's right.
You can make them better later, but yeah, you got to get something to work with. I think that's what most people would tell you. All right, we've got another special guest. So Jocelyn Jackson is going to join us.
Maybe
she is a fellow Georgian. She's a fellow Georgian, right?
Yes, she lives up the street from me, but she's in Florida right now, I think.
I'm like looking around my living room, like, where are you at, Jocelyn? Come on. All right.
She's such a troublemaker.
Her 10th novel, Mother May I, is coming out in the spring. And she is also an audio reader. Many of you probably listen to books instead of read them now. And I thought that was interesting that it's the only person I know of who's both an author and a reader. So
she's got a good voice for it.
Well, we don't know that she has a good voice for it because she.
That's right. She's not here.
Can we get hooked in?
I know she was having some trouble.
Thought I heard Chris. Chris is saying we're waiting for her. Okay, how long should we do this? I mean, I can talk to Karen all day long.
Not without a drink in your hand.
No, I was laughing that, like, because I know that you don't really drink, and I was laughing that you had liquor. Like, you're the only person who's like, the liquor's not like where you would actually drink it. It's just decoration.
It's true. The pretty bottles. That's why I got them. I'm like, oh, this one's purple. I like it a lot.
I'm going to talk out loud to somebody named Chris, who probably can hear me. You could also bring in Lisa, maybe, if Lisa's ready to go. Or I can also, I did tell Karen on, like, I just want to talk to you for a whole hour. Who are these other people? Not really. I was kidding. We can talk the whole time. But if Lisa's ready to go, we could do that. I also have more questions. So, Karen Harris was asking, so your very beloved character, Will Trent, is dyslexic. And the question was, did you have a personal connection to that? Oh, Lisa's here.
Hi.
Lisa, dyslexia, they have nothing in common.
No.
Talk to us about dyslexia, Lisa.
I don't know anything about dyslexia.
Let me tell you, it's a language processing disorder that manifests itself in different ways.
I'm going to do my official job. I have an official job. For those of you who don't know Lisa Unger, she is the author of many, many, many books and lots of awards. And her book, Confessions on the 745, just came out in paperback.
Whoop.
And you can pre-order her fall book, Last Girl Ghosted, which is fantastic. That is around the corner for fall. So Lisa, you probably have lots of, we should, out of respect for Karen Harris, who asked the nice question she followed the, like, we were talking about where we were the, like, rule followers and teacher's pets. She did the ask a question thing. So let's answer that question. So Will Trent, it's always a weird thing to ask him. No, it's not it's an interesting, when you give a trait to a character, like, how do you know that's the trait the character should have?
Well, you know, one thing is I knew he was going to be a series character, and Peter Robinson told me a long time ago, like, his only advice when you write series is don't give him an eye patch, because you'll be always writing about that. And, you know, it's a very important part of Will's personality. It's a source of shame for him, unfortunately, because when he was growing up, teachers didn't really recognize learning disabilities the way they do now, thankfully. And so they just said he was stupid, and he knew he wasn't stupid. But, you know, it's kind of hard to break away from that. So I thought that would be a good thing for him to have, because it gives him an understanding of people who have something to hide. And that's basically criminals. You know, they're hiding that, hey, I'm a criminal. But also, I think if you look at all of the characteristics for someone who's a very high functioning person with dyslexia, they tend to be very puzzle oriented, mechanical, athletic, you know, all these sorts of things that I think go into making a good police officer. And also empathy with other people. He's always looking for clues to that he's afraid, because he can't read very quickly. He doesn't want to miss what's going on. So he pays very careful attention to people when they're speaking.
I'm turning over to Lisa, because I'm sure you had things that you wanted to ask. I didn't want to monopolize.
Oh, no, you could never. She's gone. Oh, she left us. Oh, she just disappeared. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, my friend. I have your book.
Hey.
I feel like I say this every year. I feel like I always say, this one's my favorite. I think every year it's true, because you just keep getting better.
That's very nice. You're such a good friend, Lisa.
It is the truth. It is the truth, my friend. I was reading, so we've known each other for a super long time, and I'm not going to get emotional, but sometimes I do, you know, when we talk about that. And I just was reading your bio, which is something that, you know, maybe I don't ever really do, because we talk all the time and, you know, we're pals, but, you know, I'm reading this, you know, that you have sold 35 million copies of your books, and that your books are published in 120 countries. And I think it's important for just 1 minute to stop and acknowledge that, what an amazing success you are and how just brilliant you are. And I think, you know, maybe we take it for granted sometimes because we've known each other for so long, but I just wanted to say how proud I am of you.
Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you.
And, you know, definitely better all the time and, you know, always digging deeper into character and, you know, process and all of that. So I just wonder, do you have, you know, so from where you are right now, do you have something that you wish you knew when you first started out? Like, is there something that you could tell your, you know, your 12-year-old, your 12-year-old self? Is there something you could tell yourself from where you are now then? And what would that be?
Wear a bra. I don't know. I mean, okay, let's be honest. I was in my late 20s. But if I did tell my younger self to do something different, then I might not be here. You know, I'm a firm believer that you learn how to be a better person from your mistakes. I mean, if you have the capacity to be a good person, you do that. Right. You're not like trying to blame somebody. You're just trying to figure out why did this happen and how can I do it differently? Or how did I contribute to this in a negative way? So that's really, I think, important to learn. So I don't think I'd change that.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel so? You've been a reader all your life, I know. And we, Beverly talked a little bit about the Save the Libraries Foundation. But can you talk a little bit about your journey, like from, you know, like when did you have that first moment where I want to write this book? And then a little bit about the journey from writing the first book to getting published.
Well, so the first book I wrote that I got my agent, Victoria, with was actually historical fiction, and nobody wanted to publish it.
I did not know that.
Yeah, she sent it out, and I was like, okay, well, can I see the rejection letters? And I think she was really hesitant. She redacted the names because she thought I was going to call them up and yell at them. But I thought, you know, here is some free criticism of my work by all these amazing and some not so amazing editors in New York. I'd be a fool not to listen to what they're saying. And so she sent them to me and she didn't redact them very well. I still could have called them. But they were basically saying, we really like her style. We don't like this story. And I think that's important for authors to know. It's like, okay, this isn't working. Try something else. Yeah. And so I talked to Victoria and I said, I've always wanted to write a thriller. And she said, okay, we'll write a thriller. And so I had, you know, at the time I had sold my sign company. I was working for somebody else. I had 17 days with the holidays and all that where I could write. And I wrote The Bones of Blindsided in 17 days.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, of course, I had to edit it and flesh things out. Well, but basically, the structure was there.
Yeah.
And I sent it to her. And it took her. She gets mad when I say this. It took her like 6 months to read it. And she said, I really like this. I think I can sell it. And I was like, okay, well, you took so long. I wrote the sequel. And that was Kiss Cut. And so she said, send me that. And this time it took 3 months.
Yeah.
And now she reads it in a couple of days, I will say. But it took 3 months and she's like, I think I can get you a 2-book deal. And I said, well, it needs to be a 3-book deal because I just started the third one. And she said, stop writing. You know, let me see what we can do. And I mean, that, of course, that took like a few years for all that to come together. Sure. But she got me a 3-book deal and that's it went uphill from there, I guess.
Yeah, that's amazing. I can't believe I never asked you that before. I don't think I knew any of that. That's
amazing. I know you started when you were at literally 12.
Yes. Well, I did start my first novel when I was 19. I started it when I was still in college. And it was actually the book that I would publish first. But it took me 10 years to write it from the time I was 19 until the time I actually got serious about my writing and took, you know, the advice that you just gave, which is really the only advice that you need to give any aspiring writer, is just write. You know, you don't talk about writing, you don't think about writing, you don't make excuses for why you didn't write, you just sit down and write. And so that when I did get serious, it did take me about a year to finish that first novel.
So
I did start very young, and I was, you know, just almost 30 when I published the first.
Because I thought 30 was really old.
Right.
So that was my goal, is to be published before I turned 30. And I hit it right under the wire, and it published when I was in my 30th year. So yeah, it worked out.
Yeah. It's interesting. And I think it's interesting too, what you said about, you know, getting that feedback and really taking it to heart. You know, I think that is the mark of a real writer, right? That's like the mark of a serious writer. It's like, you know, I wrote this book and I know that it's the best book that I can write, but, you know, sometimes you need that editorial input, especially as an aspiring writer, when you don't have the bones and you haven't done the work and you haven't written draft after draft, you know, like to have somebody that can direct you and to be able to care enough about the work that you're able to open your heart and like sort of, you know, shed your ego to go, okay, I can hear what you have to say so that I can to make the work better. And I don't think that ever changes.
No, I think, you know, that's where you learn how to be a better writer is through editorial.
Absolutely.
Because you just can't see. And when I hear writers say, oh, and I don't have an editor, I think, well, yeah, I read your book. I can tell.
It's like, I know a lot of writers who think they don't need an editor, but I've never met one who was right about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, but you know, my editor, Kate, she's been with me since the second book, and I trust her because, you know, she kind of grew up with me in the business, and she has no problem saying no to me.
Yeah.
Which is what you need to hear. And also, don't you feel like, you know what's not working and you just and you're like, oh, please don't notice. And they're like, yeah, that's not working.
Yeah, you really, your editor's going to be like, no. And you're like, oh, come on.
But that's important though, because sometimes it's hard for you to kill your own words there. Yeah, but
for sure.
I do think as I've gotten more books under my belt, that it's not as hard. Because I always think, okay, well, I love this dynamic. I love what I'm doing here. I can use it in another book, right?
Yeah, and also too, like you kind of get the, you know, when you first start out and you get your editorial stuff, you know, you're sort of like, you know, I'm a good girl. I'm a rule follower. You know, it's almost like, okay, you have to do it or you have to change it. And then as you sort of progress as a writer, you start to feel like, you know, okay, yes, I feel this, right? Like yes, obviously this is going to make it better. But you also feel when you're like, wait a minute, I don't want to lose this piece. But then you have to look underneath the piece for what's not working.
Right.
So you have to if your editor called it out, you know, if you have a great editor who you love and you trust, you go, okay, what is it? If it's not this, then it's something underneath the thing. And you have to go looking for that to make sure that, you know, you're not just, you know, telling a story that, you know, could be told better just because you want to tell it a certain way. So
I think
the editorial process is such a, you know, is the second creative zone. Like, I feel like when I turn the book in, it's like, that's it. That's the pinnacle of my ability. I wouldn't have turned it in if I could do any better, but I know that it can be better.
Right.
I just have to get there in another draft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, but I think that you have to have someone you really trust to be able to do that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you don't want the wrong person because they can just screw with your head.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. And I feel like, I don't know, I've had a number of different editors and I feel like I've always been very lucky. I've always worked with people that I really respected. And I feel like, you know, it's a goal for me, as I know it is for you, to always be better. Like, that's what I think every day. I can be a better writer today than I was yesterday. And so
absolutely. I mean, do you have like literary writer friends and they're talking about the journey and I had to be really brave to write this. And it's like, oh, I missed my deadline. I'm 10 years behind. You just think, what world are you living in?
You're my only friend. I don't know.
Alfair likes you too.
Alfair, of course. Yeah, no, I know. And I always kind of think about that too. Like, You know, I mean, I guess it's the, what it's the, you know, it's the, is it Robert Parker who was like, you know, what do you think? They asked him, what do you think about writer's block? And he was like, well, I don't know. Like, do plumbers get plumber's block?
Right.
It's like, it's not so clunky like that. It's not so like unromantic and, you know, whatever, but it is definitely, you know, part of it. You know, it's like Alfair was saying, hi, Alfair. Like,
your other
down and right. You don't wait for them. You don't wait for the muse. That's my other only friend, right?
I feel like we should get a picture of this.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Teresa. Yeah. Cause it's all of her friends together.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you really taking a picture of us? All right. So Lisa, you're not leaving. Cause some of the last questions, I thought it would be fun if, you know, they were kind of general writer questions, but one is specific to Karen. So Karen, Amy is asking about your adaptation of Pieces of Her at Netflix.
Oh, well, this is
stuff. Do you want to talk about that?
You guys haven't heard this. So they were actually in Atlanta last week, and I got to be on the set.
What?
And see all the magic happening. Yeah.
That's exciting. So
that was really cool.
People, like, so are you involved in it? Who's in it?
So timing, Toni Collette stars as Laura, who's the lead of the show. And a wonderful woman I met named Bella Heathcote plays Andy, the daughter. And they're both Australian, which is crazy. They've been filming in Australia for the last, I don't know, 3 months. And so they're doing exterior shots here. The one I saw was weirdly at a Barnes & Noble. So it's like I walked in and I just immediately was like, okay, well, this is so familiar to me. But I got to watch them do the scenes and all kinds of stuff. The funny thing was they were planning out where the cars go, and they were on a table using Matchbox cars. And I thought, this is probably what Charlie Chaplin did. You know, that's so low tech to do something like that. But it was just really cool watching everything and exciting. And now they're filming on the coast. Which, Lisa, you know this, I'm not going to the coast of Georgia this time of year because I'll literally be carried away by a mosquito or exsanguinated. So I was like, you guys have fun. It's going to be hot. And one of them said to me, oh, but it's the humidity supposed to be good for your skin. And I thought, not if it's on fire. But, you know, Netflix is going to stream it. The cool thing is, so Netflix is going to stream it on the same day in every country they're in. So that means, like, post-production, they've got to do dubbing in Germany and captioning in the Netherlands. And every country has a different way that they like to receive foreign stuff. So it takes a little longer for post-production. And I don't know when it'll be, but it's been a delightful experience. I mean, I've really enjoyed watching the process unfold.
Congratulations. That's great. A couple questions that I thought might be good for multiple writers to talk about. So Therese Singer was asking, so we started late, so I figured out of courtesy, we'll go a little bit late. So if that's okay. So the question, it's always a tricky question to answer as a writer. And you have to be honest, because a lot of people stretch the truth, in my opinion. Do you read your reviews? Do you read your reviews? And then what impact does that have on you if you do read them?
I mean, some of them. Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to avoid that. It's very hard to avoid that nowadays. Once upon a time, I think you could say, I don't read my reviews. And probably that was okay, because unless they came like sailing through your front door or your window, like with the mail delivery or whatever, like you could avoid it. You could, like, you know, get on a plane and go to, who was it that went on a plane and went to Italy when the book was about to release or whatever, and, you know, did not read any reviews. And that's, I mean, I'm sure that's very romantic. But I don't think that's possible anymore. I mean, and I also don't think that you can sort of walk away from your release in the same way that you may have been able to once upon a time.
That's why I said I think some people don't tell them. Yeah. Like, when people are like, I don't read any reviews, I'm like, It's literally impossible.
It's impossible. I mean, like, how could it would be like, as if
it's
you knew
in your own like, paper. Like, do you throw your newspaper away?
I think it would be really hard. I think that would be really impossible to do. But I think that, you know, and I think that over a long career, you know, you read so much about yourself, right? Like, you read so many, like, really great, glowing, wonderful things. And, you know, some not so great, glowing, not so glowing things. And eventually, you know, when you've been writing for a really long time, it's just like kayaking, right? Like in big water, right? You just keep paddling, you know, you just get back to your keyboard and you get back to work and that's it. I mean, what else? What are you going to do? You know?
Well, I wouldn't kayak in open water. That's for damn sure.
Well, I know, but if you were to do that, that would be my advice. Just keep paddling.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I read some of them, but I have to stop because it's sort of like, you know, binging and purging. So I got to like be, no, you can't. Because I only believe like the one bad one. I can have 50 great
right,
ones.
Yeah. I think that's
and
right.
The one person who's like, this costs too much or this wasn't right. formatted well. I'm like, ah. Right.
Yeah. I didn't like the font. Yeah. I mean, it's, I think most, probably, my guess is most writers, you have that moment in maybe your second book or whatever, like where you read every single Amazon review, you read every, it's not a healthy place to live. My guess is most people stop doing that. But,
yeah,
you know, if you, a national outlet reviews you, people who say they don't read it, I'm like, oh, they totally read
it. No. Or your friends send it to you, which is always nice.
Right.
You know? Don't know if you saw this bad review.
Or my mother, the former librarian, like still gets things in hard copy and keeps a little, she has like a whole album of all the clippings. She has my clippings. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Another one. What were your reading habits during COVID? And did you have any books that like were kind of special to you that you read during COVID? Chrissy asked that.
Well, I think Confessions on the 745. Right?
Thank you.
Lisa's book. I should say something about, for Kathy.
Yeah.
This book.
Oh, yes.
I read a lot of nonfiction because I wanted like historical fiction because I wanted to know it was all going to end, you know, or this was fantastic. How the Word Is Passed. I really enjoyed The Other Black Girl because it takes place in publishing and it was really thoughtfully done. But mostly I've been returning to short story collections and things like that, that I've loved before because I just wanted something familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I read a lot during the pandemic. I read a lot of nonfiction books and I was lucky enough to receive, you know, as we all do, receive some early stuff as well. So I read things like Her Dark Lies by J.T. Ellison, which was really excellent. I just read Allison Galen's new book, which is upcoming.
Oh, it's so good. Can we talk about how good that book
is? It was so good.
It's called The Collective.
It's so good.
So
yes,
good.
But next week, not this week.
But also, Karen.
Not this week. Exactly. It's not out. It's not out yet.
You read False Witness. In the fall, you read The Collective.
Yeah. And,
and Lisa's Last Girl Ghosted.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And Last Girl Ghosted. Yeah. And Michael Carita's newest one. And I'm also reading... another book by a new horror writer named Scott Carson, who happens to just like, he looks a little bit like Michael.
He looks just like Michael.
I think he's a little more handsome because I've met Michael and this guy, he's got it going on.
Yeah.
I like Michael at all.
So I just started that. And I just immediately kind of just got hooked into that. And you know, I mean, I guess I'm kind of reading on a continuum, you know, fiction and nonfiction. I always have multiple books going. I'm always listening. I did a lot of listening to podcasts during the pandemic. I did a lot of that. And so, yeah, it's just an ongoing all the time.
Well, we should mention Joss because Jocelyn Jackson was supposed to.
Yeah,
she's her internet.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, yes, but
I'm
she wrote
about that.
What did she write? I wrote it down here. Mother May I? Yes, that was an excellent book. She's a really great and creepy writer. And we should say she couldn't show up because one of her cats decided to be a sovereign kittison. And so they've been dealing with a lot of legal paperwork.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's the same.
Okay.
Well, that kind of leads me to the, I did want to talk a little bit about like the humor in your books. I mean, they're always very serious, but there's, I mean, I, of course I can always hear your voice, right? Like when I'm reading it. Yeah. So I'm always like kind of laughing myself. One of the things I love the most was all the pet names, all the fish names and the, and the cat names as well.
Swim Shady. I'm so proud of that. It's like, I hope I'm remembered for that the most.
Yeah. There are a lot of memorable animal
Mr.
names.
Darcy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I had so much fun coming up with those. And there's like with a French fish, pun.
Fishy pun names. Fishy pun names.
Yes. But there's a Great Pyrenees. And Great Pyrenees, as you both know, have two dew claws. And so he's called Dew Claude. Those are bonuses in the books, folks. Bonuses.
I feel like, but your own cats don't have punny names.
Well, they, you know, cats go by several names. They all have aliases.
Oh,
so,
they all have.
It just really depends on how they're behaving that day.
So is it true that your cats really don't like each other? You joke that they hate each other, but
no,
is that
they
true?
Do. They really, every cat wants to be in a single cat household. And, you know, like they're always fighting and slapping. We got one who's a big slapper. I mean, she'll just walk around the corner and bap, 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 bap on the other cats. And, you know, the young cat's like, what'd I do? I don't remember chasing you and biting you when I was 3 years old. So it's a whole thing. I imagine it's like having children, except you get in trouble if you lock children in a room. Maybe. I don't know, Lisa.
If you get caught.
Yeah. Right? I would never do that to a cat, though. You know that.
Yeah, kids, I know. Sure.
Well, Karen, congratulations on your 21st huge international best-selling novel.
Thank you.
Witness. It is quite a triumph. And I know Lisa said the same. Every time it's like, I think it might be my favorite, but I think it might be my favorite. So congratulations. And thank you for including us in the launch.
Thank you for
all the bookstores who are streaming this. And thank you to everybody who signed in and tuned in. And this is it. We're going to say goodbye.
Bye. Bye. Congratulations, Karen.
Thank you.
Thanks, there. I feel like we got to hang out together tonight.
Yeah.
I know, but now they don't know. The very nice Chris is like, tell me definitively when we're saying goodbye. Bye.
Bye. Yes, this is bye.
Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.